We're going to move now to case number three. This is appeal 24-2134, Jacob Allen Powers versus John Noble. And Ms. Colbert will begin with you for argument on behalf of the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court. With the government's concession letter that was filed on Friday, the issues in this case are narrow. Number one, was Jacob Powers' due process right to be competent at the time of trial violated? And number two, was trial counsel ineffective for failing to raise that claim? The seminal cases on competency, Dusky, Drope, Pate, all stand for the proposition that an evidentiary hearing must be held when there's a bona fide reason to doubt competency. The record in this case creates, there are many substantial facts that create a bona fide reason to doubt Powers' competency at the time of trial.
Here we, as I understand the history, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Powers had a criminal case involving either a competency or NGI issue predating this case.
Correct.
The state court case.
Correct. In the year 2000, a completely separate case, he was found not guilty by reason of insanity. In the year 2000, this case was, I believe the complaint was filed in 2005, so 5 years prior.
So by normal operation of Wisconsin law, what would occur is he would be placed in, not incarceration, but be placed in a medical facility that would infringe on his liberty for the period of time that the NGI status would occur for that first crime before the state court case here. At some point then he was let out, and then this occurred in 2006?
2005.
And as I understand, again, the state court record for this particular state court case, no issue raised of competency, no issue raised of NGI.
Correct.
And then first competency determination made after the sentencing here, correct?
After sentencing, state post-conviction counsel was appointed, and I believe she met with Powers 4 months after sentencing, and she said that her meeting, she felt he did not understand the issues in the case. She had questions about whether he was competent to have made the decisions at trial that he needed to make, and that's when she hired Dr. Glassman to conduct both a contemporary examination for competency, so whether he was competent to proceed on the appeal, but also Dr. Glassman is the only evaluator who conducted a retrospective competency exam on whether Powers was competent at the time of trial. Dr. Glassman determined he was not competent at the time of trial.
But to be fair, said so, did not say so in the report, but did say so in his testimony.
I believe that the direct words of the report do suggest that he was not competent at the time of trial. The testimony on the report is clearer on that point.
Clearer on that point.
But I believe the words is something to the effect that he believed that competency would have been or should have been raised, given his conclusions.
What are we to do then with the Schenecker report and the Dolezal report, both of which conclude competence?
Competency, of course, is a present determination, and Dr. Schenecker's report was he did not address trial competency. He addressed only whether Powers was competent to proceed on appeal. And Dr. Dolezal also had a very discreet competency determination, whether he was capable of filing a pro se petition for habeas within the deadlines. She determined he was not competent to do that. Both Schenecker and Dolezal determined he was competent to proceed with the appeal. But as the state prosecutor argued in 2007, what is asked of a criminal defendant at trial and what is asked of a criminal defendant on appeal is very different, and of course trial decisions require much more of a a criminal defendant than their role on appeal.
It's not a lengthy trial record, correct?
It is a couple-day trial.
Right. And, you know, a close review of the trial record seems to indicate that, I mean, Mr. Powers is engaging with his lawyer. I mean, none of us can invade that attorney-client privilege and know the conversations Mr. Powers may or may not have had with trial counsel, we understand is now deceased, correct?
Yes.
Correct. But we do see from the record, I'm at page 202, he recalled street addresses. Page 203, he described what time certain events took place. He articulated where people were located, when relevant. He explained what was playing on the TV. He testified about what he said to people throughout the night at 2:15, and he identified some potential biases at 2:24 to 2:26. Now, it is clear that he has got some IQ and serious issues. I mean, he can't read above a fifth grade level. So, we're talking about a mental health question. There's no one gainsays that, but there is this interaction that occurs with his trial counsel. Then he does fence a little bit with on cross-examination. A prosecutor examines him on pages 228 to 236. He denies knowledge of the victim. He attacks the credibility of the government witness. There's pushback that he's giving. So this is the trial record we have before us with regard to the competency. So we can't know what was going on between his lawyer and him as to whether or not to raise NGI or competency. We do have the trial record, and then we've got two of the three saying competent, albeit after the fact. Then the overlay on this, I apologize for the length of this question. The overlay on that is we're now 19 years later. How are we to sort that out other than to rely on the record that we have?
Well, I think what Your Honor has just articulated is exactly what the district court decision and the government rely on, is his appearance and demeanor at trial. And doesn't that show that he's competent? He was able to answer questions. He was oriented to time and place. But it's a foundational principle that demeanor at trial does not end the inquiry. When there is both Pate and Dusky talk about specific, when the record is clear that there is other mental health deficits, when there's a history of irrational behavior, you must have an evidentiary hearing to determine whether the defendant is competent or not. And the district court says in its decision that, quote, Powers' significant intellectual deficits and mental health impairments could support a finding of incompetence. That statement is essentially saying there is a bona fide reason to doubt competency here, but the court then went on to say he is competent based on the record. And that is contrary to the governing standards of a competency determination. If there is too much time that has gone on, and in this case there's almost 19 years, but there is a bona fide reason to doubt that Powers was competent, then the writ should issue if we cannot determine it at this time. And there are many cases that have done that. This court has done that in McManus versus Neal is an example. The issue of Powers being able to participate in the trial is not just answering the questions, and that is clear from Pate and Dusky, but also Cooper v. Oklahoma 1996 specifically discusses the fact that being competent encompasses the ability to work with counsel and cooperate in counsel, encompasses the ability to rationally decide whether to take a plea or not. And in this case, there's a lot in the record that suggests that Powers did not have that capacity. Powers was not the sort of defendant where you could give him his plea deal and say, do you want to take it or not? He needed all the evaluators who found him competent discussed that he had difficulty with abstract reasoning and decision making, and the only way to do it would be to repeat, to go over, slow pace. And the record suggests that his trial lawyer did not spend time with him, did not spend enough time with him.
Counsel, I have a question on the record there. But in the bigger picture, I view this as a question of whether the judge should have sua sponte, based on bona fide concern, inquired into competence. And do you agree with me that is what's in front of the trial judge? We don't go say, well, there were other things the trial judge didn't know about, because that's a sua sponte decision. And then we have, was it ineffective assistance of counsel for counsel not to have raised it? Is that your position?
Well, I think that it should have come from counsel. Counsel is the best informed, and counsel should have been the person to raise it. However, so in this case, the judge only knew what the judge knew from viewing Powers. But once we had the post-conviction competency hearing, where we had a competency report that said Powers was not competent at the time of trial, we had an expert testify, then the court, this should not have proceeded without an evidentiary hearing on the question of whether he was competent at the time of trial. That never happened. And that could have happened meaningfully in
Attorney Hex was the one who's, I believe, right, and said, hey, I second I saw my client, competency came to mind. I had these, I went, I got an expert, got a report. She then goes back and talks to Huzzah, I think is the name of the original counsel that was deceased, and she decides not to pursue that. What are we to make of that? I believe that there was an affidavit in the state court. I don't think that record, that's in our record, but what are we to make of that?
This is precisely where the state, Wisconsin State Court of Appeals unreasonably applied the no merit standard. We don't know what to make of that. The Court of Appeals should have gone back to Attorney Hex and asked, where is the evidence? We need more in the record to know why you would have changed his mind. You made these representations in writing and to the court that you did not believe that he was competent, and then you file a no merit report that says he is competent.
But I thought your claim here is ineffective assistance of trial counsel.
It is ineffective assistance of trial counsel, yes. And trial counsel should have raised it. There is also ineffective assistance of appellate counsel, but that is not before this court because of the government's waivers. I also note that I only have a few minutes left for rebuttal, and I'd like to reserve that.
If I may ask just one quick question.
Sure.
You're the expert on Wisconsin law around here, with the exception of Judge Crennan. Is it permissible for a state trial judge in Wisconsin to raise the question of trial competency sua sponte?
Yes.
Thank you.
And we'll be giving you time for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Colbert. Mr. O'Brien, we'll now move to you for argument on behalf of the state.
May it please the court. The district court correctly decided the outcome determinative issue in this case when it held at page 18 of its decision that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals finding that it was reasonable for trial counsel not to challenge Mr. Powers' competency to stand trial was a reasonable application of Strickland. A fair-minded jurist could agree with that finding, because who would know better, after all, whether a defendant is capable of understanding the proceedings, consult with counsel, and assist in the preparation of his defense than defense counsel? And that this attorney chose not to raise that issue, presumably knowing of Mr. Powers' mental health history and cognitive deficits, and yet counsel was satisfied. And post-conviction counsel looked at this record, and yes, we had the post-conviction hearing where she found an expert, Dr. Glassman, who found Mr. Powers not competent for the post-conviction hearing, His opinion about his competency at trial was really gratuitous, because the only issue at that hearing was whether Mr. Powers was competent to assist counsel in the post-conviction and appellate stage of the proceedings. Be that as may, the court questioned, Your Honor questioned whether or how, what to make of Attorney Heckey's decision to raise the issue of Mr. Powers' competency at the post-conviction hearing and yet write a no-merit report saying that there's no arguable merit to a claim that trial counsel was ineffective for not raising the issue. And I think the answer comes down to counsel was concerned when she's discussing what goes on at the appellate level and what will happen at the post-conviction hearing. And then she found Dr. Glassman, who agreed. But then the hearing was held, and Dr. Scheniker was appointed by the court and provided a very thorough report and then testified. And I would refer this court, please, to review Dr. Scheniker's report and his testimony, which the post-conviction court relied on in holding that Mr. Powers was competent to pursue post-conviction hearings. And then after that, counsel discussed the case with Attorney Haza, who, as the court is correct, is now deceased. And presumably, counsel learned from Attorney Haza what happened and why he, Attorney Haza, felt that Mr. Powers was able to understand the proceedings, was able to assist counsel in the preparation of the defense, which was a quite simple defense. It was basically, I didn't do it. She's lying. And yes, Mr. Powers has deficits, yet that is the sort of defense, and Dr. Scheniker was clear, and even to some extent Dr. Glassman, that he does understand basic things like the roles of the attorney, the role of the prosecutor.
At least as to the first prong of Strickland, when you have appellate counsel not that long after trial, immediate response is there's a competency issue. You have billing records that would suggest that that wasn't addressed by trial counsel. And trial counsel has before them a prior NGI, a client who does have some borderline mental issues. Doesn't that raise some concerns?
It could, and certainly, and I'm assuming that trial counsel was aware of all that, but then the law presumes that he made a reasonable decision not to challenge his competency, and I assume based on his discussions with his client about the nature of the defense, whether or not to testify. And I think both Glassman, well, I think all of the experts, Glassman, Dolezel, and Scheniker, agree that if you spend time with him and explain things to him, he'll get it. And especially in a case like this, where it was a fairly straightforward case, the issues were quite simple. And he did, and the case law is clear that his demeanor, his actions at trial are relevant. And everything that occurred at trial seems to indicate this was someone who understood what was going on and was able to work with his lawyer to present the defense that I didn't do it.
Mr. O'Brien, two-day trial, is that correct?
Yes.
He said, she said circumstance?
He said, she said, although there was the state had his roommate corroborating their claim that he assaulted her.
Yes. And no opinion testimony offered at underlying state court trial, correct?
Opinion testimony, no. I want to make sure about that as far as like delayed reporting or anything like that. No, my recollection is not. It was, basically the victim's testimony, the roommate's testimony, and Mr. Powers' testimony. And there may have been one or two police witnesses. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
And the counsel talks about this bona fide reason to doubt competency. One thing needs to be made clear. That is not the constitutional standard. And Dropey, Missouri, makes it clear, and I would refer this court to Dropey, explaining where that came from. That came from Kate B. Robinson, which was quoting the Illinois statute and case law, talking about a bona fide reason for competency, to challenge competency as the Illinois standard. And Dropey made clear that that is not the constitutional standard. What the court in Robinson held was that's adequate to satisfy the constitutional standard. So this idea, and I know that language is repeated in the Warren v. Bainin case in this court, but I think you need to be careful to understand where that came from. And that it's not, the standard, again, is, was it reasonable, and especially under Strickland, was it reasonable for counsel not to question his client's ability to understand the proceedings and to assist in his defense? And certainly one reasonable defense attorney could say, Judge, I've looked at my client's history. He was found NGI 6 years ago. Maybe I'm not, I think he's okay, but maybe we should have a competency evaluation. But another reasonable attorney could say, I understand his history, but he seems fine with me. We were able to prepare this defense to you. We've gone through his testimony. I've tried to cross-examine, you know, whatever, and I'm satisfied. So, I mean, it really, it is a case-by-case thing, and it all focuses on the present ability of the defendant to understand and to assist at the time of trial, not 6 years previous, not even a year after. So even though we cite those post-trial reports as relevant evidence, the most relevant evidence is what happened at trial. And the Court of Appeals reasonably held that a reasonable attorney based on this record could reasonably conclude that there was no reason to raise the issue. And yes, the judge could have sua sponte raised it, but the judge saw no reason to, and the judge mentioned that at sentencing, that he seems, yes, he has deficits, but he seems to be able to understand what's going on, at least at sentencing. And so I firmly believe that, if nothing else, a fair-minded jurist could agree with the district court's conclusion that it was reasonable for the Court of Appeals to hold that it was reasonable for trial counsel not to challenge his competency, because, and that's a reasonable application of the deficient performance prong of Strickland.
Mr. O'Brien, felony conviction, Fond du Lac County, is it likely, or do you know, if a pre-sentence investigation report would have been created for the sentencing here?
There was a pre-sentence. Yes, and I think, and I know counsel cites it at some length in the brief, and there's discussion in that about his mental health issues, his background, and I think one thing that it's important on the no merit review, this wasn't just a quick once over. This was an extensive record. Even by the time it got to the Court of Appeals, by the time the case was reviewed by counsel to decide whether to file a brief on the appeal, there was an extensive record that included all of his mental health issues, the pre-sentence report, the trial transcript, and the post-conviction hearings, post-conviction reports, and post-conviction counsel's discussions with trial counsel. All of that was before the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals independently reviewed that record in addition to reviewing counsel's no merit report and agreed with counsel that it was reasonable for trial counsel not to have raised this issue. And I just believe that, especially if we're talking about deferential review under ADPA of the deficient performance prong, I don't believe this court can reasonably conclude that no fair-minded jurist could agree that trial counsel performed reasonably. And furthermore, on the issue of prejudice, we agree with the district court that there's no reasonable probability that he would have been found incompetent had the issue been raised by trial counsel. And so, assuming that's not deferential review, what this court should, there's plenty, the district court's analysis is about as thorough as it gets of this, what it called the 1,700-page record, and reasonably concluded that even if had the issue had been raised, he would not have been able to prove prejudice.
Thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Unless there are no more questions.
No, thank you, Mr. O'Brien.
Thank you.
Ms. Colbert, let's go back to you with 3 minutes for rebuttal.
So quickly, I'll just go through a couple of points. As far as the reasonable application of Strickland, this court has held that when the both in Burt v. Uckman and Newman v. Harrison, that ignoring a favorable decision or a decision that finds the defendant incompetent, that is an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law, an unreasonable application of Strickland. Also, the government was talking about a lot of presumptions and assumptions. This record, there is very little in this record because there was never an evidentiary hearing on the issue of trial competency. In other cases, the district court has ordered an evidentiary hearing on the issue of retrospective competency and trial counsel's performance in Newman v. Harrison, as well as Price v. Thurmer. Also, all the cases cited in the district court opinion about what about these individuals who have mental health, people who have mental health problems are not all incompetent. We have examples of that in case law. If you read through the cases cited by the district court, in all of those cases, there was an evidentiary hearing at some point, either in the state courts or in the federal district court. Once there is reason to doubt competency, it's a foundational principle that there must be an evidentiary hearing on the issue. That never happened here. It should have happened because trial counsel should have asked for it. It should have happened because the judge should have sua sponte asked for it. It should have happened because the Court of Appeals should have rejected the no merit report. It didn't happen at any one of these junctures. It could have happened in the district court. Now, we are so far past we're 19 years. I don't know that it would be constructive to have it at this point, but since it hasn't happened, we are left with just a multitude of facts, pages 34 to 36 in the opening brief, that outline the reasons to doubt his competency, and so this court should issue the writ.
Ms. Colbert, you were appointed counsel. You have our great thanks. You have to review this lengthy state court record, followed by a lengthy federal court record. We very much appreciate your professionalism and hard work here. So thank you. Thank you. Mr. Bryan, we also appreciate your hard work here. The case will be taken under advisement.